I have to start by saying that this class was somebody else's idea. This was not my idea. Which is to say, it's an unusual topic for me. I'm not the business manager here. And yet I think I do have something really definite and specific to say about this, but this is not going to be along the lines that a class such as this one might normally be taught. And it's an experiment for me. I've never, ever taught this subject before. And so here we are. I just thought I would start with full disclosure. You may go downstairs and get your $25 back if you want. I'm just going to have to do it the only way that I know how to do this. We'll just have a good time and see what happens. There are other sources. In this valley, there's no shortage of people telling you how to make money. It was very carefully titled Secrets of Prosperity, not How to Make Money, or even there's a great book, which I intend to actually teach a study course on this book called Money Magnetism, which Swami Kriyananda wrote, which is also very unorthodox in its very unexpected, slightly unexpected. People are catching up to all the same ideas these days. But it's a book about money that isn't much about money, is why I say that. More about the magnetism part of it. So I think I'm just going to sort of start in and just tell you sort of why I end up in this position at all, standing up in front of you on this subject, and we'll sort of work backwards from that and see if we can figure out what's universally relevant. In 1971, when I first came to Ananda Village, I was 24 years old, and in a short period of time after I got involved in the community, which is the rural community up in Grass Valley, which was at that time the only Ananda there was, I was very interested in health food. I was actually sort of a health food fanatic, was actually the word for it, for a number of years. I was certain that I was very close to self-realization because I hadn't had any sugar in about 3 years. I had a real close association in my mind between diet and spirituality. But I was interested in food. I didn't know how to cook exactly, but I did know about food, so I ended up first being an assistant in the community kitchen, which served the guests at the retreat. And I was assisting this older woman named Shraddha. And feel free to just make yourself comfortable anywhere you want. You lie down, sit down, it's fine. Soon after I started working for her, she left in the middle of the night, just sort of took off for some reason or another, and I suddenly was left in full charge of the kitchen. First, I had to learn to cook, which took a little bit of time and a lot of patience from my friends. But I also sort of inadvertently, because of the situation that was there, I ended up also controlling the financial situation there, which wasn't that hard, but I had no experience at all managing money. I married when I was 19 to an extremely capable man, and so I went from the protection of my father to the protection of my first husband, who just took care of everything, and I never knew. I had an intern period, which I'll tell you about, and then I have been under the protection of another extremely competent man. The net result of that is I've never balanced a checkbook in my life. Although somebody must have balanced this checkbook. I never did, so I don't know how it worked. But I had control of the finances for a brief period of time. At the end of that, Swami Kriyananda, who is my spiritual teacher and the founder of Ananda, after about 6 months of my managing that checkbook, announced to me, lovingly, kindly, respectfully, that as long as he was alive and in charge of Ananda, I would never be responsible for another checkbook. And he's kept his side of the bargain. And I've never had actual financial management of anything, including myself, except for the period of time when I was earning $50 a month in cash, and then I did manage all that money myself. But nonetheless, people think I'm qualified to teach this class. So I'm just giving you an idea of where I'm coming from, because on the other side of the equation, I have to say I have never lacked for anything in my life. And I have had extraordinary opportunities, and I have had an absolute sense of confidence. I can't become insecure on the issue of money. Now, I don't mean to attract down on myself a lightning bolt because pride goeth before a fall, or demonstrate some kind of hubris that says I'm beyond these needs, because I never really have been desperate or down and out or anything like that. But I also just sort of seem to have a feeling about how this whole flow works. Not that I've ever operated it in any obvious sense or on any grand scale, but I do think that I have some intuitive experience from past lives about the essential secrets of prosperity. Not handling money, not generating money, not running businesses. I really don't know those things. Although I maybe now, after 30 years, if I was actually given a checkbook, I could deal with it. Although I often think sometimes being one of those just totally helpless women in that field, what would I do if my husband died and I suddenly had to pay the bills? I decided I would bake cookies for someone and they would do it. That's my secret of prosperity. Also, seriously though, is to recognize what I can and can't do and then apply my energy where I have energy and then draw to myself, because I have followed other secrets of prosperity, which is to cultivate a wonderful circle of friends, you know, who we all work together. I do for them, they do for me, and it all works out. And all of these things are not unrelated. After I no longer had the checkbook, I just had the food, that went on. Shortly after, I separated from that husband, who was very competent with money, and we followed in that marriage something that didn't really work that well, but our principle was what we called the 100% efficiency principle, which is whoever was best at it did it all. So he did all of the financial things because he felt he was better at them. In retrospect, I'm not sure he was, because I think I had a greater sense of prosperity than he did. But he had a greater sense of how to handle money. Although, to his credit, he's also been able in his life to do exactly what he wants, which is also a kind of prosperity. You know, he's never had to compromise his fundamental needs and values just because of the need to earn money. He's always figured out a way to do it, right, which is a very important principle too. So anyway, shortly after that, I became single. And in the context of Ananda Village, where I lived at the time, I joined the monastic order, became a nun I have subsequently married, but for 8 or 9 years, I lived single with no expectation of getting married. We were very, very poor in any objective sense. You know, we were extraordinarily prosperous in every way that mattered, but we're exceedingly poor as a community in that we had just taken on this amazing experiment. It was the late 60s and 70s when we did it, back to the land, buy land, work together, make it happen. We weren't a commune. We didn't pool our resources. We worked in a traditional economic way, which is salaries for money and everybody paid rent and so on. But it was like one gigantic mom-and-pop store is what we called it. Like if you have a mom-and-pop store, you know that if you take much out of the till, there's not going to be as much on the shelf the next day. So every time you make any gesture that's going to take care of yourself, you have to recognize you're also taking away from the potential success of the project. And also the sense of a mom-and-pop store is that this is ours. It's not like when you work for a faceless corporation and if you're taking more than you're giving back, you don't have any sense that you're depriving yourself. Whereas if you're in a mom and pop venture, you know that it's your own self that you're depriving, and so you have to balance your two needs. So the early 10 years of building Ananda community, even though we were, you know, some 150, 200 people working together, it was still a giant mom and pop store. And everybody who was really dedicated to it took as little as they could out of the till because we wanted to be able to put more on the shelf so that we could keep the business running. So I had a little trailer. And most of us at that time were in our 20s. Very few were married. There were almost no children. And so it had also that sort of freedom of just, we didn't need anything. We were too young to really think about the future. I'm astonished when I hear people in their 20s talk to me about retirement. I had this man talk to me about his retirement. He's just graduating from college. I said, maybe you want to have a life first. You know, maybe you should have life first and then think about it. But it was just like, there was no sense of security, because our security was, well, many things, but that's too long an interlude. I don't want to stick it in there. But we just worked for almost nothing and lived at an absolutely simple level. And we had no television, no radios. Most of us did not have cars. When 10 women together bought one Volkswagen Bug, we just thought we had just died and gone to heaven, because we now had access to a car, which I filled with diesel fuel really quickly. and nearly destroyed it. So that car, and then later, did I fill it with diesel fuel? Someone filled it with diesel fuel, because later I drove it over a rock and smashed the transmission. I don't think I actually did both things. I think I just did one of them. But you know, there was no recovery from things like that. You know, it was like goodbye car or pray for guardian angel, of which we had a few. But so for 8 or 9 years, we lived like that. We had no electricity, but also it was great because it was an entire culture like this. We were just a monotone culture of single young people with very few kids, and the kids just got along. And I lived in a trailer, which was shorter than the length of this room, probably from the harmonium to here. It was a little bit wider than this. And I could go like that, but I couldn't energize. It was green on the outside and orange on the inside. Somebody had a really clever idea. Yeah. I loved it. I had a little tiny table, a little folding chair. I finally found a folding chair small enough to slide between the table and the wall so that when I had a guest, they would have a place to sit. I was so pleased. I could put out the guest chair. I had a little chair for myself. I had a little place where I could cook. I had a little burner and then the all-important gas heater. I couldn't live without heat. I had the burner. And I actually had cold running water. I was so incredibly. In this trailer, I had cold running water. And all the others, you just had gallon jugs and you just filled them from the tap. Then I had a little narrow bed and a little meditation space. But more could a single person need, right? I just would move from, you know, section to section. Like that. And I got $50 a month in cash that I kept in this little jar. I had this wonderful little ceramic jar that I kept my money in. When I married David, who lived in a very different manner, as I will describe, that jar to me had really become my secret of prosperity. And so I moved into his house like a little refugee, you know. I was pretty enfeebled after, skipping ahead, but after a couple of months of living with David, who has always had an elegant sense of style. Everyone gives David credit for the woman you see in front of you now. as Swami Kriyananda said, she looks a lot nicer since you married her, David. And I'm the first to say it's absolutely true. Sometimes I say to David, what did you see? He said, I saw a lot of potential. But anyway, after a few months, David opened the closet and said, can we throw away all your clothes? And I mean, I just looked at him. It was just this extremely enfeebled collection of things. I said, if you buy me new ones, no problem. So we pretty much threw them away. But I came with this little ceramic jar because I would get my $50 in cash and I'd put it in that jar. And it was an opaque jar. That was a very important part of the system. I couldn't see actually how much was in there, and I often didn't look. I just would put it in there and I would pull it out as I needed it. And I needed food, and not very much of it, and I needed heat, basically. So I had to buy big propane tanks, and I had to be able to buy food. I didn't have a refrigerator, so that was a little problem, but peanut butter keeps, popcorn keeps, you know, they're just things that really keep. And life was exceedingly simple, and it was a monoculture. Those are very important points. And I also knew that I was exactly where I needed to be, doing exactly what I needed to be doing, and I was doing it with my whole heart, mind, and soul. And therefore, I was certain that God would not punish me for that, right? It wasn't merely that God would provide for me, which is sort of a positive way of looking at it, but I also knew that life would not punish me for being exactly where I was supposed to be, doing exactly what I was doing, fearlessly, courageously, and with tremendous amount of energy, okay? So those were sort of the first things. I didn't even think about it because by the grace of God, I just came in. I have a lot of other issues, believe me. But one of my bigger ones was not, you know, financial insecurity. Somehow I just have always expected somebody to take care of me. Who, what, I don't know. But I'm trying to sort of give you some sense of where that comes from so that we can transfer it. Because the older I've gotten, the more I've realized that this is unusual. Whereas to me it seems perfectly common, I've begun to understand it's unusual. I look at the circumstances of my life, which are very unusual, so I'm willing to understand what people go through. I've never had, as I say to people, a real job since I came to Ananda. I've always been in this context. But, you know, things relate. So I did that for 8 or 9 years, and I had several principles that were my absolute principles. Swami Kriyananda was actually the one for many years who gave me the $50 every month because I worked directly for him. And he had actually worked out a deal where I didn't have to pay certain other community fees, and so that's why my salary got way down to that $50 a month. And somehow it must have gone up a little bit at one point. But in any way, but there were. I was there for spiritual reasons. Now, I know that this story isn't entirely relevant, but I'm just giving you my context. I was there for spiritual reasons. I was there. First, I came there because I wanted to learn from Swami Kriyananda. I didn't come really because of Ananda, the community, the mission, and so on. I came because I had this tremendous connection with Kriyananda in my heart, and I knew that he could teach me what I wanted to know, and wherever he was, I needed to be there. As I wrote in a letter recently, I wasn't severely tested because I was living in San Francisco and he was up in Grass Valley. I just had to drive 2.5 hours and get out of the car. I didn't have to go to Antarctica or to India or to the Himalayas or anything. I just drove to another part of Grass Valley. But in my heart, I would have gone anywhere. And so everything, I knew what my main event was. I had a very clear, unequivocal sense of my main event, which was and there was no way I would sacrifice that for anything. Okay. Now, in Swami Kriyananda's book, Money Magnetism, he makes a real strong point of concentration, one-pointedness, having no doubts, and we'll talk about this in a few minutes. And I, looking back, I see that one of the things that I was working with without even knowing it was just this absolutely single-minded, that nothing could touch the power of my first commitment. I knew just what I was doing. And so when any other thought would come up related to something I might need or have to have, the concentration of where I was so strong that it just couldn't get a foothold, you know. And Swami talks a lot in this book about how one of the reasons people have so much trouble being successful is because they're always allowing something to make them waffle on their first premise, right? And so I see that what worked for me partly was just I had this total faith in my first premise, which was the fact of what I was doing. And so Swamiji was teaching us a lot, because of course he is a spiritual teacher, and he doesn't teach in the sense of being like trying to be deliberately acting out from the book of what spiritual teachers do. You know, I sometimes think lesser teachers try to act the part. Swami talked himself specifically about one particular man that he was sitting in a room with him, and he was sitting there reading the newspaper. And then some of his, quote, devotees came in, and he folded up the newspaper and tried to act as if he was doing something else. And that's, unfortunately, all too common. Kriyananda is so natural in his leadership that he doesn't try to think about what to do. He just responds primarily intuitively to situations without necessarily demanding, even in himself, some rational construct to that. He just acts as an instrument, and then enjoys himself as the way things unfold. Now, that's a very high level of functioning. And I'm sure all of you at times have done things that you really didn't know why you were doing them, but later realized that it had a very, very distinct and regular purpose. He functions, as far as I can observe after 30 years, almost entirely on that basis, and just knows to trust it at this point. As a result, many things would happen that would turn out to be perfect for us. Now, one of my principles, because my goal in life was to be with Swami Kriyananda, was that any opportunity that was to be with him, I would take it, again, assuming that it would work out, because God wouldn't punish me for doing what was the right thing. Now, there's a lot of premises behind my confidence, and that we'll talk about the difference between wishful thinking and actually being practical, because where a lot of people crash on the thing that I'm describing to you is that it's wishful thinking, in that they haven't put their entire life in alignment with this. It's just like much of your life is out of alignment with your main event, but then when you have to take a risk, you try to take that risk anyway, but you don't have the support because you're contradicting it in too many other areas. My life was in total alignment with Kriyananda being the goal. So he himself, because he has a magnificent sense of the flow of energy and therefore the flow of money, he said he's always been that way, even as a child. He said when he went to college, his father sent him, what, $3 a week or $3 a month, whichever would have been appropriate. He said he treated all his friends on that money. And then he sort of smiled and he said, I don't know how it worked out, but it always did, right? In the sense that he's always understood that if consciousness and magnetism is right, everything else follows. And I'll come back to that again, that too, in a moment. So Swamiji would often, the opportunities to be with Swamiji were often quite expensive. You know, sometimes stunningly expensive. like, he was paying on my salary. He knew that I got $50 a month. And I remember on more than one occasion, we go out for dinner, and there was a policy that Swami always put in place, which all of Ananda uses now, which is you always divide the bill evenly. And in the early years, when we had so little money, that was really something, because that meant you couldn't go and hold your portion down. You sort of couldn't go with this contractive sense that I'll just order a small salad, you know, because everybody else is ordering full meals and coffee and dessert, and you're going to get your percentage of it anyway. So, I mean, maybe you can keep the total down $2, but you're just, I would love watching sort of people who get sucked into that circle the first time, and then somebody say, well, we'll just divide it evenly. And they go, just like that. Once, many years later, we were in Southern California on a big event, and we went to this restaurant. This was when money was flowing a little more easily. But there was one person in that group who was very lavish and just loved to play the big guy. So we went to this restaurant, and they started ordering non-alcoholic wine. And he just really liked playing the big guy, so he kept having, you know, more bottles brought out. He just ran the bill up to here. So by the time we were finished, it was $70 a couple, which at that time was a lot of money, okay? So we all just bit the bullet and did it. Now, that wine made me sick. So just at the very end of the meal, I had to rush to the table, and I threw up the whole dinner. And one woman said to me later, she said, I don't think my husband would ever have forgiven me if I'd thrown up that dinner. Like a coup de grace the whole evening for me to just throw the whole thing away like that. But that's all beside the point. But we go out with Swamiji, and you'd have to pay for a dinner that would be like $25 or even $15, you know? And he knew perfectly well that you didn't have any money. We just smile, you know, and you just put it in. And my rule was, if he asked for it, I do it. He knows my situation, and if he's asking me to raise my faith, to raise my energy, to raise my magnetism. And I absolutely promise you, never did I end up short of money when I did that. At the beginning of the month, sometimes I'd give away half of my salary. But things would happen, like people would invite me over to dinner 10 nights in a row, you know? Or somebody would give me money, you know, just unsolicited. I never went around and said, I'm out of money, you know, like this. I would find money in my own pocket, which I promise you was impossible. Because there would be no way that I could leave a $20 bill in a pocket and, you know, and not know that I did it, because there was no margin. Now, of course, such a thing could happen easily because enough money runs through, but there was no money that could run through. And I just wouldn't look in the jar. I would just reach in, you know, and pull out the money. There would be a great warm spell in the middle of winter, and you never had to turn on the heater, so your gas tank would last longer. And they were, quote, miraculous things, but they were also just the way things would flow because I knew that I was right on the main event. And another incident which happened much later, toward the very end of this cycle, because this whole cycle ended in 1981 when I left that lifestyle and went to live with David, and then the rules changed entirely. It was very interesting. When I was a single renunciate woman living as a nun, the world responded to me in that way, and all sorts of people took care of me, you know, and just, not that I would ask them, but there was a sense, you know, from the universe that instruments had to come through. And so just money and things would come. As soon as David was protecting me, like all that just went away. It wasn't needed anymore, right? It was because now God knew I was in someone else's hands, and he has always had a tremendous sense of money and prosperity. He's also a money manager, as well as being a prosperity manager, but when he took over, and when I came into him, I carried the jar, you know, like the little refugee with her suitcase in my jar. And it was an ugly jar, besides that. He said, what's that? That's the jar where I keep my money, you know. And I can remember him very gently sort of taking it out of my hands and saying, I don't think we'll need this anymore. But I was really afraid when he took that away. And I had to just breathe in and breathe out and just figure, this is all right. He has a checkbook, you know. He has a different way of dealing with this. And I didn't become passive. I have not become passive. I'm still not engaged on that level, but all the same principles still are at work. And I learned from him a whole bunch of others, about really how the flow of money works. Because for him, he's run a number of different enterprises, started enterprises, managed manage checkbooks, balance checkbooks, you know, just that kind of thing. He, too, runs very, very intuitively. When he ran a business, he ran the publications business for Ananda Village many years ago, and he was helping to develop it. And he also has been a money manager for so long that he just can do it intuitively. He kind of puts it, he kind of hold the checkbook and tell whether it's in balance or not. And when we were first here, or after a few years here, and someone else was taking over the actual writing of the checks and so on, he just, at first she complained because she'd come back the next morning and realized that he'd been rifling around. And finally he told her, he said, look, I just have to touch it. I just have to come in there and just kind of just feel it in order to be able to feel confident that it's happening. And when he ran the publications business, he never did it with budgets or spreadsheets or anything like that. He brought it out of debt into a very positive flow. It was a small enterprise. The next woman who took over, she tried to run it like he did. And after a few months, she just realized she just didn't have his intuition. You know, she didn't have as many lifetimes of money management behind her. So she actually had to go to a different mentor, someone who was much more online with what her actual consciousness was, and she had to teach her, you know, just much more methodical, ordinary business methods, because she was beyond herself trying to do it like David had done. Now, that also is relevant to what I'm trying to say to you. A great deal of what I recognize has worked for me in my life is just because of who I am and because of all the other factors in my life, some of which I'm going to describe to you. But part of being very successful in your own flow of prosperity, one of the most fundamental things is being able to be very honest about your own reality. And not, it's the balance between being very positive and being affirmative and not being what we call practical in your idealism. Because if you don't have the fundamental attitudes in place, you can't work the rules that are based on those attitudes. You have to go back and work with those attitudes. Now, let me just give you a few of them. And as I warned, a couple of you came in late, but I warned all of you, I'm winging this. We're just going to run around and see where we end up, okay? One of the things that I realized, and of course everybody is different, and I have to use myself as an example because this is the only one I understand on this one. Recently, I had to go on a very strict diet, leaving out all sugar and just a whole, it was a very strict diet just to balance some inner physical conditions, which were not serious, but it was better if I balanced them. I went over Christmas, the whole Christmas and holiday season in this way, and because I was paying a lot of money for supplements and for the whole treatment thing, it was an incentive for me to also follow the diet, because otherwise I would have just wasted lots of money, and I didn't want to waste it. Plus, it's not that hard for me to follow a strict diet. So I just set my mind to it, and in fact, Christmas, it was the best Christmas I had, because I wasn't filling my body with junk the whole time, and as a result, I felt better the whole time. So I'm going to try to do it again this year. We'll see if I have such a powerful incentive. But in any case, after 3 or 4 months of this very, very strict diet, and people, because we all live very close together, people began to know that I wasn't eating anything. There was just a lot of like, oh my gosh, wow, isn't that amazing? Look what you did. And I just say, look, everybody has their strengths, everybody has their weaknesses. My problem is that I tend to think it's my job to tell everybody how to live their life. I have to get up in the morning and say, now today, remember, don't interfere with everybody's life, you know? Don't go around telling everybody how to live. Now, not everybody has to get up in the morning and say that to themselves. But for me to not eat sugar is like, you know, it takes some effort, but it's no biggie for me. Everybody's got their own particular areas. So part of your success in what you set out to do is to be able to know what you're strong in, know what you're weak in, be very realistic, and not just think that if I affirm it, it's going to be true. You know, for me to just affirm that I'm going to remember not to interfere in people's lives isn't enough. I have to set up a whole lot more structures than that. For me just to say I'm not going to overeat, I'm not going to eat this, that's all it takes for me, pretty much, and I can do it. Now, let's see, I had a point with that. So when I was back at the time having no money, people would ask us sometimes, you know, how did you do it? And I said, well, it was really, really simple. You simply couldn't buy anything. And actually, it's really easy. You can't buy anything. So there's just no point even in starting. There's no point even in starting down the road of what am I going to get and what would I like to have. In other words, you don't, like, stand at the end point of your desires and try to deal with them. You start at the origin point of your desires. You start at the point where the thought first arises But you really, it would just be great if you had 3 shirts instead of 2. You know, or wouldn't it be fun to go to Nordstrom's again? Do you remember Nordstrom's? You know, like, oh, wow, wouldn't it be nice to be able to walk into Nordstrom's one more time before I die instead of always going to Goodwill or to what we lovingly called the free box. There was this big object we called the free box in Ananda, and you would go to the free box and you would find whatever you had at the free box, which is part of the reason David suggested we throw away all my clothes. You know, sum total in that closet was probably equal to 1 object that we actually bought. But it wasn't a hardship. There wasn't a sense in my mind. There was a sense in some people's minds. I didn't feel deprived because there was no, and this is the secret of prosperity, is that you mustn't ever feel deprived. You must always know that I have made choices. You know, I knew that I was a very bright lady, very energetic. You know, and in a matter of a week, I could completely change my financial condition if I wanted to. So what I was experiencing had nothing to do with anybody doing anything to me, nor did it have anything to do with actual lack. I wasn't lacking anything. I had absolutely everything that was important to me. That was sort of how, when I was going through the Christmas experience not having sugar, there was no sense in my mind, really, that I was missing anything. I had made a decision that this is where I wanted to go, and it happened to be a decision that was realistic for me. When Connie Hernandez was talking to me about this, I mean, she was being very tentative, and I said, no, I can do this one. Tell me I can do this one. Tell it to me, I can do this one. But other things, like when my husband asked me to clean out the bathtub on a regular basis, scrub it with Clorox, I can't actually say yes to that because I hate cleaning out bathtubs. So even though that's a very simple request, and other people could say yes to that easily, I can't say yes to that easily because I know then, at the time he asked me, I didn't have the willpower to promise that I would do it because I hate doing it, right? But I didn't, so I would feel deprived and put upon if I had to clean out that bathtub instead of hiring somebody to do it. But to go years without buying new clothes, because it was a trade-off. I was in a mom-and-pop enterprise doing what I needed to do. I didn't want to take the money out of the till. And if I had prioritized those things, I would have had to let go of what I knew was the main event. Right? And so, again, I never felt deprived. Now, it's very important not to feel deprived because, and this is a very fundamental law here that I'm actually just beginning to understand. So I can't explain it with 30 years of authority. But Swamiji writes repeatedly in many different places, just going from the simple basis that science talks about now, which is that this universe is energy. It's not fixed physical. You know, we think of it as physical. There's a cartoon that I loved. It was put out shortly after Einstein's theory of relativity, talking about matter being an illusion and energy being really the substance of the universe. It was a New Yorker, a thoughtful New Yorker cartoon that was put out. And it was a picture of a street in New York. And you saw all the different characters. You saw the street sweeper. You saw the taxi driver. You saw the mother with pushing the little baby. You saw the businessman walking down the street. And all of them seemed to be paused in thoughtful reflection. And just like life had been interrupted for a moment while they contemplated greater realities. And the caption of the cartoon was a quotation from Einstein, and it said, people will have to gradually become accustomed to an energy concept of the universe. And so you saw all these people trying to accustom themselves to the concept that the world was really energy, not matter, right? Now, all around us, we have proof of that with all the technology that's happening and science and the spirituality. People are just getting that energy is the reality. But we don't think that way and we don't behave that way. In other words, we know that it's an energy reality, but we try to accomplish things in this world by means that are more material than magnetic. Okay? If you're dealing only with energy, energy responds to other forces of energy, to vortexes of energy, and to the magnetism generated by a vortex of energy. When energy spins, think of a tornado, it spins. The more the energy moves, the more a vortex is created, and everything is drawn into it. And so what's really happening in this world, that we look all around us, is not the final result which we see, which is somebody has a good opportunity, a bad opportunity. What we really see is it's always energy and magnetism interplaying. And what is drawn to you or not drawn to you is the result of the magnetic field that you yourself are putting out. Okay? Now that magnetic field, yes, may be manifested by the fact that you've made a very good business plan and you act on it. But even the ability to do that or to have that be successful depends on the kind and the quality of energy and magnetism that you yourself at the origin point are putting out toward it. Now, can you follow that? Does that make sense? Because that is everything. And when I look back over my whole life, I basically realized that by the grace of God, I've had good magnetism. You know, and it's karma. I accept that it's karma. My karma could change tomorrow, and I could just be in a whole different kind of test. You know, the test that I've had this life has not been on that level, and I've been fortunate to be able to practice when it's been easier, sort of having a good magnetism. Swamiji says you don't create anything, you attract it to you. You attract it by the magnetism you're putting out. So in other words, the concrete things you do matter, but what matters most of all is the consciousness, the thoughts, the attitude, and the inner energy that you're putting out, the quality and the quantity of the energy you're putting out. If the quality or the quantity of the energy you're putting out is not good, it really will make very little difference how organized you are on any other level. Now, both are important, though, quality and quantity. Now, when I married David, he had a reputation for being successful. He'd run a couple of successful enterprises before he came to Ananda. He seemed to be able to make things successful. I mean, he's not J.P. Morgan. He's never been successful on that level, but he just fundamentally knows how to make things work. He has good luck, too. Swamiji reminded us that, I think it was Napoleon. Napoleon would only appoint generals who were lucky at cards. Because he wanted to have generals who had good magnetism. I joke a lot because David always wins at cards. He just always wins. I mean, sometimes you can beat him. He wins all games. Sometimes I just get so frustrated. It's not that we play games a lot, but once in a while when we're on vacation or something. I'm a lousy card player fundamentally, but even when I concentrate my utmost, he just has karma that's better than mine. He magnetizes success to him. But I did also notice two things when I first began to live with him, because he taught me things that I didn't know at that time. This is now, I'm talking almost 20 years ago. The first thing I noticed was that I was ready to go to bed and he was just starting on the night shift. Was that the sheer quantity of work that he did was way more than anybody I'd ever seen. And it was just like, no wonder you're successful. You do a lot more, that's all, you know? And he also didn't do a lot else. Now, I don't mean he was unbalanced, but he didn't scatter his energies. He just, whatever it was that he was responsible for, he just stayed on it on a very constant basis. The other thing was, he never resented doing that. He never looked at it as, this is such a burden, I have to do this now. I mean, not once. And another man that I know, many of you know Ram, he's a big black man who comes, and he and his wife Diana speak here in our church every once in a while. They're coming again next month, and mark your calendar. I mean, he's something to experience. Both of them are. But he's great big. And he actually was all the way into the 49ers training camp with football. But then he decided that he was too humble to be a professional football player. He just didn't have it. He just didn't have that spirit that you needed to be a football player like that. And one characteristic about him, he has tremendous magnetism. Everything he tries to do works for him in some way or another, completely illogically. He's far more intuitive than rational. He just can do things. And if you don't flow with him, it drives you crazy, because he's not always really grounded, but he'll end up where he's trying to go. But once he had to spend like 6 or 9 months at Ananda Village doing telephone sales for the book company, because there was just nobody else to do it, and he has the capacity to just do that sort of thing and make it happen. And his wife would say to him, "You don't really like this job, do you?" And he would say, "No, it has to be done. It's just fine." And then a few days later, "Tell me, honey, you don't really like this job, do you?" She could never get him to say anything negative about it. And it wasn't an act on his part. It wasn't even that I don't dare say anything negative. It was that he looked at it. It had to be done. and he was the one to do it. And then there wasn't another question after that. In this Money Magnetism book, Swamiji talks about, he has a whole chapter in the back called The Tricky Subconscious. And it comes after the chapters on the need for concentration, the need to be able to put out quantity and quality magnetism. And I'll talk more. I mean, this is only the first hour of this conversation, but the tricky subconscious that just is always in there, and you're trying to go forward and it's trying to go backwards. You're trying to go forward and it's trying to persuade you that you shouldn't. And Ram, again, everybody has their own karma, but he learned the lesson of positive a long, long time ago, so that for him it's not a discipline. You know, it's even less of a discipline than my not eating sugar. He has trouble with ice cream, more trouble with ice cream than I do, but he has no trouble with being positive, because he just looks at it. If it has to be done, then this is what I love doing. Just 1, 2, 3. David also is very good at that. It's just sort of like, why would I think about whether I like this or not? He just sort of looks at you. I mean, of course, he's male and I'm female. I have 100 reasons why I want to know what I feel, right? But he says, what do I care? And it's not so much a question of not knowing or so on, but what's the point of knowing? All it's going to do is basically guarantee I'm going to put out a lot of work and nothing will happen. At least if I put myself one pointedly behind it and just day after day, just put one foot in front of the other, at least at the end of it, it'll have been worth it, because we'll have accomplished something. Plus, my own experience of it will be so much more fun, because I won't be sitting here all the time I'm doing it wishing I were doing something else. My way is different slightly. I don't have endurance. As a result, I'm enormously creative. I have a friend of mine who has tremendous endurance, and as a result, isn't nearly as creative as she could be. Because when she gets into a situation, her way of solving it is just to keep doing it. I get into a situation that I don't like, I know I can't sit there and complain, and I can't endure it, so I create a new solution, right? And in the direction I'm trying to go. And another one that Swami talks about in here, and also in here, The Secrets of Prosperity. And once I said to Swamiji, when Ananda was trying to work on his money karma, when people decided that maybe we didn't have to be as poor as we were, and this idea that we would affirm prosperity came forward, and people were sort of going everywhere looking for answers about, you know, how to be prosperous, because there's so many different teachings. I said to Swamiji one day, you know, there must be something inherent in the path of self-realization. We don't have to go to unity or to this to find it. I said, how would you describe the secret of prosperity? His answer was very interesting. He said, creativity.